People of Note on Fine Music Radio is proudly brought to you each week at this time by Peter Turin Productions. Fine Music Radio, and this is Rodney Trudgeon welcoming you to this week's edition of People of Note. Now, cricket has played a huge part in all of our lives, hasn't it? At the beginning of 2016, and a fascinating book has just been released with an interesting tie-up. Listen to its title, Empire, War and Cricket in South Africa. The story of Logan, of Mikey's Fontein, and of cricket. And it was written by Dean Allen, who is my guest today. This is a fascinating biography of James Douglas Logan, the man who gave us Mikey's Fontein. It's also the unique social and political history of the workings of the British Empire in South Africa during the late 19th century. And it's described as an entertaining and at times unbelievable story of cricket's origins in South Africa. And Dean Allen's association with South Africa began in the 1990s, developed further during his postgraduate studies at Stellenbosch University. He's taught extensively at universities in South Africa, as well as Australia, Northern Ireland, and his native England. And he's also published extensively in the areas of sport, history, and sociology. And Dr. Dean Allen, it's very good to welcome you with such a nice book. Welcome to Fine Music Radio.
Thank you, Rodney. What a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
I want to know where this passion came for Mikey's Fontein and for writing this book, which is apparently part of a PhD.
Indeed it was. It's been some journey. As you mentioned, I first came to South Africa in the mid-90s and fell in love with this country. And then I started to embark on my academic career, which led me into the field of sports history. I wanted to understand more about the unique history of this country, but do it through the lens of sport, which is such an integral part of South Africans' lives. And people had mentioned this place, Mikey's Fontein, out in the Karoo, and there was a cricket connection. And not only that, just as someone who was interested in the history of this country, I should go and visit. So I think it was the late 90s. I first went out there for a weekend, and I was absolutely enthralled by this place. People that have visited there or know about it, it's a perfectly preserved Victorian village in the middle of nowhere, basically. And then the more I dug, of course, the more I realized that this was an undocumented story. I mean, a Scotsman that arrived in the late 1800s, penniless, and made his money very quickly and built this town. But not only that, there was a cricket connection. I'd heard that the first English cricket teams had played at this place.
The first ever in South Africa?
Not the first ever. That's part of the folklore, I'm afraid, that surrounds the place. The first test match, of course, took place in Port Elizabeth. But Mikey's Fontein was famous for certainly hosting the early English cricket teams, and the cream of South African cricket played out there. A first-class cricket pitch was laid out there in 1894 to the cost of thousands of pounds. And why? That's what
I was going to say. Why
exactly?
Because it's a long way away. It's 3 hours from Cape Town.
Indeed. And by this stage, of course, I'd started my my master's degree at Stellenbosch. I was looking at sport during the South African War, that period which has shaped so much of our history.
Right.
And I realised there was such a gap in the story of cricket. So my chapter on cricket really did expand, and which led to a PhD, most of which was completed at Stellenbosch. I was between England and South Africa at that time. And then I embarked on writing this story of James Logan of Mikey's Fontein. There hadn't been a book written about him apart from one book, a rather amateur history, should I say, but by reading that book by Robert Toms, Logan's Way it's called, I realised there was an incredible story, and this was something I had to get my teeth into. And so with the time and the inclination and the passion to do this, I discovered this amazing story which has led to this wonderful book, as you said.
But there's a lot of things to tie up there, isn't there? There's cricket in South Africa, sport in South Africa through history. There's the Boer War. There's Cecil John Rhodes, isn't he? Yeah, because he's in the book, I think he's in your first line.
Yeah. Cecil Rhodes, of course, is in the news now. I mean, the first line of my book says Cecil John Rhodes is on record as saying he only met two creators in his time, himself and James Douglas Logan. I mean, this was fantastic stuff. As I mentioned, this book has taken me, with the PhD and turning it into a book, has taken me probably 10 years of my life. So the whole issue with Rhodes at the moment makes it even more contemporary. It means it's something we can discuss at the moment.
Absolutely. And, I mean, look, the colonial element as well is very important, isn't it? Because that's how, in a sense, cricket came to South Africa. So although colonialism as well at the moment is very unfashionable, we are in a situation where something like this is important. It was there, it existed, and a lot of good did come out of it, like cricket.
Well, I was privileged enough to arrive in the mid-90s when the archives of this country really opened up. I mean, colleagues of mine and myself, we've written about the rich African history of the game, for example, and other sports, not just cricket, rugby and football. So there was certainly a need to write a history like this. And as I said, it was missing. It was part of this kind of, it was folklore surrounded this story. Now, Cecil Rhodes and James Logan and these kind of people, of course, they became benefactors of sport at that time. Yes, they made their money through diamonds and gold and through, yes, unscrupulous means. They exploited people.
But was Logan also a bit like that?
Very much so. And I bring that out in the book. I mean, I don't pull any punches. I mean, this is not a book to glorify that period, but it actually explains the kind of legacy that these people left. And one of those legacies was international sport. James Logan was responsible for bringing the first international teams, albeit cricket, down to South Africa. And once Southern Africa or the colonies of Southern Africa were part of this imperial brotherhood, then the thing really did expand. So that's a lot of my work has looked at sport, how it created this idea of empire and brotherhood. And you only have to look at places like the West Indies, Australia, India especially, where sport was taken and cricket was at the center of this relationship that existed between the mother country and parts of the British Empire. And here in South Africa, it occurred relatively late, but of course it was on the back of diamonds and gold, and there was no coincidence with that, of course. Sport was brought down at a time when the political associations were trying to be strengthened because of this major discovery of this wealth.
What sort of time span are we talking about, Dean? When can you put a finger on when the first cricket match was played at Mikesfontein?
Well, the record, I was interviewed on Test Match Special at Durban, which was quite a privilege, and Jonathan Agnew asked me that, a similar question. I mean, the first cricket that was played in South Africa is on record as being in 1802 with the arrival of the British military here. So cricket was being played here, but it was with the arrival of the international teams, the English cricket team. The first team arrived in 1888-89. Major Wharton's team arrived in the Cape. But what it needed was people, benefactors, who could put up the money to bring these teams down. Step forward our Scotsman of Mikesfontein, James Logan, who would then get involved from 1891, which is the arrival of the second English cricket team, and the rest is just an incredible history. So we're looking at the late 1800s, but as I said, it really does parallel the discovery of diamonds up in Kimberley and later gold.
And then there's the Boer War.
Of course, of course.
But let's come to the Boer War and that tie-up in a moment. But your first piece of music, I was interested in your list of music, Dean, because you've chosen music that somehow connects you to South Africa. And the first piece, Flat Stanley. Tell me why this is here.
Yeah, I mean, the music I've chosen really is a soundtrack to my experience here. I mean, when I first arrived in the mid-90s, I was privileged enough to study at Stellenbosch University. Of course, as a mature student at the time, I was a little bit older. I had this music that was a backdrop to many of my experiences. Flat Stanley is a now Mac Stanley, of course, a Cape Town band. The voice of Andrew Mack, the big man with the big voice. Absolutely beautiful tunes that this band produced. A little bit later, I think I first experienced them in the mid-2000s. Their first album of Secrets and Wine, which this track comes from, really is a soundtrack to my South African experience at that time.
Behind my feet. When you speak, you address my soul, my soul, my soul.
That piece called Renegades by a group, Flat Stanley, the first choice of my guest, Dr. Dean Allen, whose new book, Empire, War and Cricket in South Africa, has just been published. And your, as you say, your South African soundtrack to the music that you've chosen here.
Yeah, beautiful song that. Flat Stanley, who are now called Max Stanley, of course. They had to change their name, I believe, because of a cartoon in America. But still very active here in Cape Town and produce some wonderful tracks.
I just want to carry on our conversation about Mikey's Fontaine, because I remember when I first saw Mikey's Fontaine, I couldn't believe it. This little sort of Edwardian Victorian outpost in the middle of the Karoo. And for some reason, names like Kitchener come to mind. Is he covered in your book? Does he play a role?
Well, of course, Kitchener is very is a central figure in the South African War, and like a lot of the famous generals of his time, Ironside and Haig, for example, he would have stayed at Mikey's Fontaine, and James Logan would have been the genial host. There was a suggestion actually by Kitchener and then Milner later that Mikey's Fontaine may be even used as a concentration camp or
really
a detention camp,
yeah,
later on. But of course, for James Logan, Mikey's Fontaine was this wonderful resort, health resort, that he built in the late 1880s, and the rich and famous stayed there. So he had the likes of Olive Schreiner, our famous South African novelist,
yeah,
who was based there, who wrote some of her finest work at Mikey's Fontaine. She described the wonderful isolation of the place and the exhilaration of a train arriving from Cape Town and bringing that, you know, that element of civilization, as it were.
Have you ever done that, been on a train and passed through Mikey's Fontaine?
I have. I experienced it about 2 years ago, after the book had been finished, actually. It was the one thing I wanted to do, because I'd read how the cricket teams and how Logan passed through the Hex River Valley and all these wonderful scenes, and it was exactly as I imagined. I mean, it takes quite a long time to get there.
Yes.
But to go through this place and to see its isolation, certainly in terms of the railway, because that's how it was built, of course. Forget the roads. I mean, the roads bypassed it now. But then there's a piece in the book that up to nine engines at a time, the London Times correspondent wrote, were actually in or around the vicinity of Mikey's Fontaine. This was a real sort of hotbed of rail traffic at that time, and it was bringing the rich and famous. So we mentioned Olive Schreiner. Another famous resident was George Alfred Lohman, who W.G. Grace, that famous Victorian cricketer with the,
yes,
with the fine beard, described,
yes,
as the greatest cricketer of his generation. George Lohman arrived in the 1880s. He was sent down by Surrey Cricket. He played for England. He's still got some of the finest bowling figures for England, would you believe, even to this date. But he was suffering from consumption, or TB. And James Logan met him as he got off the ship at Cape Town docks. He was on his way to Beaufort West, another famous Karoo resort. Logan said, "No, my dear boy, you're coming with me, all expenses paid." And now, of course, he had the famous novelist in Shrine, and he had a world-known sportsman. So it brought him publicity, and,
yeah,
and it brought, you know, the rich and famous to this unlikely destination in the Karoo.
That ties up with the story that I wondered, because I knew that someone had set up Mikey's Fontaine, or someone went there for health reasons, for asthma, or as you said, TB or something. Because,
yeah,
you said earlier it was used as a place where you had this perfectly clean air.
Well, they talk about the champagne air of the Karoo, don't they? And
they
James
do.
Logan marketed that, of course. I mean, how he actually came about to create this town is an interesting story. I mean, he arrives in 1877 as a penniless Scot, a working class Scot, who was on his way to Australia on a ship. It docked in Simonstown. Clearly by that stage he'd had conversations with people, and diamonds had been discovered. This was a wealthy part of the world. He takes his chances as a young man. He gets signed off by the ship's master, and he makes his way to Cape Town Station. Within a matter of months, he's promoted from porter to Cape Town master of Cape Town Station. The guy clearly had charisma and some ability. He'd had experience. He'd worked since the age of 14 back in the borders of Scotland on the local railways. So he had this experience. But the reason why he got to Mikey's Fontaine, he was offered the position of district superintendent of that region. Now, Mikey's Fontaine existed. It was a small railway siding with a couple of kind of tumbled-down buildings. But Logan saw the potential of this. He wanted to create his own empire. He'd now acquired wealth through diamonds, of course, some through the catering facilities that he acquired, but not as much as been made out in the past. And he wanted to create something where no one else had done anything, and that's what he did. He built this oasis in the Karoo, and he bought the land around Mikey's Fontaine. He bought the adjoining farms, and that's when he set about building this Victorian village.
And the Milner Hotel, did he build that as well?
Very much so. And I mean, that's the Hotel Milner, Hotel as it Milner. Was called. David Rawdon, my good friend, the late David Rawdon, of course, changed the name to the Lord Milner, even more imperious. But it was the Hotel Milner, named after Alfred Milner, the Cape Governor of the time. Logan knew which side to keep on when in terms of his politics. That only was completed just as the South African War broke out. It was the only time that this Scotsman really was, he had an aspect of ill timing. But it, of course, he turned the whole thing round. The cover of my book shows how he used the publicity. We've now not got the rich and famous day now. We've got the cream of the British military. He invites the British forces to base themselves at Mikey's Fontaine. So the Hotel Milner now is housing, as I said, people like Ironside and Haig and Kitchener at the later date. And of course,
strategic move.
Without a doubt. And of course it protects his town from what we could say divided loyalties from a lot of the farmers and the Afrikaans population in that area. But that is just the end of the story. Leading up to that, Logan had built this incredible reputation of a man who could do no wrong. And he did that through cricket. He did it through politics. He entered politics in 1894.
In South Africa.
In South Africa. He was a member of the Legislative Assembly here in Cape Town. And, of course, he was one of Rhodes's, you know, staunch allies. He was one of the progressives, as it were. But what I like about Logan, I think, or what I admire about him, it was his own party. He was one of these political chameleons that kind of crossed the floor when it suited him.
Yeah.
An incredible story that some of your listeners might have heard of is the Logan contract controversy. He had a good friend within Rhodes's first government called Sir James Sivright, and he was the guy that gave away the government contracts. Now, they were fellow Scotsmen. They were good buddies. Sivright is the chap that was famed for bringing the telegraph down to South Africa, or part of that. He was knighted by Victoria as a result. He gave his friend James Logan the monopoly of all rail catering contracts for 18 years without putting it out for tender. Now, does that sound familiar in terms of...
I was just going to say. Actually, I wasn't going to say, but does it sound familiar or what?
And that basically brought down Rhodes' first government, because John X. Merriman, who was a more principled member of that government, he called Rhodes back from his holiday in England and said, enough is enough. These men have their fingers in the pots. And Rhodes was forced to dissolve his first government. He had to reform a new ministry as a result of that. James Logan was at the heart of that.
Gosh, as you say, what a character he must have been.
Incredible.
And landing with his bottom in the butter, by the sounds of things, and making just the right contacts, and entrepreneurial as well, all those things.
I think he was the ultimate entrepreneur, and as I said, it was opportunity, arriving at exactly this time. And I think that's how a work like this or a book like this should be taken, in the context in which it's written. It would never happen again.
Not at all. Absolutely not. Now, another piece of music, Dean Allen. This is Arno Carstens, I see.
It is, yes. Now, Arno Carstens, of course, the lead singer, or the ex-lead singer of the Springbok New Girls.
Yes.
But I followed Arno's individual career, as it were, and this beautiful track, Another Universe. It was the soundtrack to my visit. I remember to the Wanderers in 2005, watching England, South Africa on a previous visit, and I heard this song over the tannoy, and it stayed with me ever since. A beautiful track.
Let's take the final bow. Let's make the silent sign. Nobody needs to know where we're off to. We're invisible alive. We're the whispers in the scream. We're not living in the West, and we're not coming from the East. Sharp is the knife, and alive is the night. I'm gonna slit the throat of the Holy Ghost. Ceremony to the UFO. An SMS on where we wanna go. Ooh. From the galaxy of blues to a universe we choose. No more crying and just maybe.
somebody to hold.
A well-known South African artist, that Arno Karstens, and the song Another Universe. And it was the choice of my guest on People of Note here on Fine Music Radio this week, the author Dr. Dean Allen, whose book Empire, War and Cricket in South Africa, Logan of Mikesfontein, has just been published. Dean, just before we come back, because there's so many questions I want to ask you about Mikesfontein, Logan, cricket and the Boer War. You've spoken a lot, like this music, about your passion for South Africa. When you first came here, whenever it was, 1990s, why? What brought you here? Why has South Africa done this to you?
Well, I'm a proud Englishman. I was born in the West Country, in West Somerset, on the edge of Exmoor, so a beautiful part of England. And I'd had no connection with South Africa at all. And I first arrived as a tourist. I actually met a South African dentist, would you believe, back in my native Somerset in Taunton. And she invited me here to actually come on holiday. And as soon as I arrived, of course, I saw the mountain and the beaches. But more than that, I engaged with the people. And I realized this is where I wanted to be. And ever since then, I've probably spent as much time here as I have in the United Kingdom and elsewhere. As you said, I've worked in Australia, in Ireland. I've been privileged to have traveled the world with my work. But South Africa is where my heart is, where my soul is. And for the past 5 years, I've been working at here in Cape Town, here permanently. I was working at Cape Peninsula University of Technology. And during that time, I got my permanent residency, which was a very proud moment. And forever, I will have a relationship with this place. And I consider it home as much as I do England. And of course, it's the people that mean so much to me. And the response to this book has been absolutely incredible. As I explained, Rodney, I do a lot of talks and I travel the country. And the passion for this subject and South African history is there from all backgrounds. And that's something that really does inspire me. And I aim to come back as much as possible in the future. And undoubtedly will settle here again at some point. As I mentioned, I've just taken a job back at Bournemouth University last June from a career point of view. But really, this is where my heart is in Cape Town.
So if you were to describe your profession, how would you do that?
Well, on my business card, it says author, lecturer, historian. And I think I'm probably a mixture of all those. I mean, I enjoy people. I enjoy talking to people. I mean, writing the book was the hard thing. But actually going out there and presenting it is an absolute joy. I suppose I'm an academic. I'm a senior lecturer at university, and I enjoy working with students and teaching. But it's spreading the knowledge and talking about this subject and engaging in these kind of things, which are fundamental to our South Africa of today. We talked about roads earlier. We talked about this colonial legacy. It is part of our history. The great man Desmond Tutu himself, when the whole Rhodes controversy at UCT started, I mean, he said something quite interesting. He said, we must respect each other's history. We can remove statues, we can remove certain aspects of our history from the past, but they did exist. We need people to engage with those histories and write about them. As I said, I don't glorify it, but it needs to be discussed, and it needs a book like this, I think, is rather unique in South Africa. At my PhD viva, which was back in 2008, which is quite a terrifying experience for anybody who's done a PhD, I had three history professors back in England speaking to me. But the one said, I've done something unique here. I've brought together these wider themes of empire, cricket, culture, war, imperialism, but I've run it through the life of an individual. And that was a big challenge, of course, because, you know...
That individual being Logan.
Being James Logan of Mikesfontein, of this place. And the more I dug, the more I realized this was an incredible story. So my supervisor at the time, she said, Dean, you must turn this into a book. This is far too good of a story to be an academic work, you know, lost on the dusty shelves of some university. So to answer your question, I think I am an author and a lecturer foremost, and a communicator and a public speaker. I think that's what I enjoy doing more than anything.
But I'm still intrigued about you said there was a spark that really got you going on this book. Because, and it comes through this, was Mikesfontein affected by the Boer War in any way? Did it ever see any action, any fighting?
Well, it did in that area. But the visitors of Maikiesfontein, one of the things it's famous for is the fact that you can still walk the veld around the town. You can still see the bully beef cans and the bullets and the thick Victorian glass that 10,000 Imperial troops left as they worked their way up to the front. They were camped there from late October 1899, and Logan, offered his town. So you can feel it, you can sense it, it's tangible, you can touch the history still there today. In terms of action, there was the Siege of Sutherland I write about, which is a lesser known siege. It was bloodless and it was very, you know, the notes were sent between the two opposing sides but that happened. Logan was aware that certainly in the guerrilla phase of the war, there were commandos moving around, shots were fired in the vicinity. Jan Smuts brought his commando just north of Maikiesfontein through that region. But remember, Logan had the British guarding his town. Yes. He even raised his own Maikiesfontein mounted infantry. Of course, they never saw active service because the British Army was there. But what it did, it gave him good publicity. He was the ideal colonial, and he was thanked for that from no less than Victoria herself. But the story that really sparked this interest was when I visited Maikiesfontein and I started to read more about the man. And I couldn't believe that James Logan was behind a cricket tour, the second ever South African cricket tour that left these shores back to the old country. They toured England during the South African War in 1901. They left Cape Town in April 1901 and they toured the United Kingdom as a first-class tour while the war was still going on. And that was what really inspired me to write this story.
My goodness. Sorry, just let me get this right. You mean he took a South African team, a team of South African cricket players, yep, to England in the middle of the Boer War?
He had already sponsored the early England visits in 1891 and again in 1895 and 1899. He was the man that put the money up to bring these English teams down, but his great ambition was to take his own team. Remember, he's new money, he's a working class man, he needs to buy social elevation, as it were. He does that through this game of cricket, but to do it, to really achieve his aims, he wants to take his own team back to the old country. He tries to do it in 1899, of course. His friend Lord Hawke in the corridors of the MCC agrees to this, but the war breaks out. But that provides him with a surprising advantage.
As we say, entrepreneurial par excellence.
Indeed. The South African Cricket Association had disbanded, of course, because you don't play sport when war is taking place. It's a far greater game. James Logan gets in touch with his friend Lord Hawke, as I say, back at Lord's in London, and they organise a first-class tour, and it takes place in 1901. And an incredible part of this story, they arrive as Arthur Conan Doyle of Sherlock Holmes fame writes in the press, "How dare a team of South African cricketers arrive on our shores when they should be fighting a war back in their own country?" James Logan, the wonderful self-publicist that he was, a media man, remember he'd already bought his own newspaper in Worcester, so all the news that came out was he controlled that as well, turned the thing round and said, "Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, I understand your sentiment. I'm an imperialist myself." But he said, "Can I point out, I myself have done my duty in this war, supposedly wounded in a battle, which would never happened, and my cricketers have all done their bit." And within weeks, he turned the publicity round. He became a darling of the British press, and he went on to play W.G. Grace's team at the Crystal Palace. He went on to play the MCC at Lord's, and there's wonderful pictures in the book which document this tour, which is the second official South African tour to leave the South Africa for England.
Okay, we're going to come back to that and also to those pictures. I'm going to ask you how the cricket team did in view of recent events here in Cape Town. But your next piece of music, Watershed Angel, is this another local sort of journey for you?
Yes, indeed. Watershed are a South African band that have been around for a number of years now, and I remember being at Stellenbosch University, and they visited Paul Roos School, and they played in this, actually on the edge of the sports field there. They've gone on to fame and fortune now, of course, but this was in the early days, and their first album was absolutely stunning, and this track, which is one of the most well-known ones, came off of that, and it really does bring back good memories.
Standing with a smile, and everywhere you seem to go, I notice that I follow you. I come to my senses sometime, sometime, sometime. Every time I look at you, I see this picture, perfect smile, shining down on everything you see. I don't know what's wrong with you, you radiate some love in me. Me, I'm growing stronger every day. I see a better side of me, a loving side I didn't know was there. A loving mind, a loving soul, a tide of love, a love of gold, waves of emotion in the
group Watershed, a piece called Angel, and another choice of South African music from my guest, Dr. Dean Allen. We're talking about his newly published book, which is proving to be completely fascinating, actually, listening to Dean, Empire, War and Cricket in South Africa, Logan of Mikey's Fontein. And what I wanted to ask you, just paging through this book, you have the most beautiful pictures, and before I ask you about where you got them from, because it's incredibly illustrated. It's like it's an archive, actually, of historical photographs. But there's a picture here. We were talking about our team going across the UK, London County versus Logan's team. And you've just pointed out here W.G. Grace, known as the champion. But who is that sitting between his knees? And I'm not sure if I believe what you're going to say.
Incredible story, Rodney. No. So James Logan has taken his own team, his own South African team, over to the old country in 1901 in the midst of the South African War. And his own son, James Logan, only plays cricket, first-class cricket, once in his life, and he does so for his country. Of course, James Logan selects his team, his son, Jimmy Logan Jr., to play quite high up in the order of the batting lineup as part of the South African team. So the picture you refer to in the book, of course, is we've got the most famous Victorian after Victoria herself, W.G. Grace, sitting there with his team of professionals, London County. And in between his legs, sitting in a team photo, is James Logan Jr. So if you want to play cricket for South Africa, make sure your father controls the team.
That's an excellent story. But there's so many stories that I just want to get into this book. Where did you get all the pictures from? As I said, it's like a magnificent archive of sport and Mikey's Fontein in South Africa and the Boers. and Victoriana.
Yeah, no, the pictures I'm very, very proud of. I mean, it was something I really wanted to incorporate within the book, not just as a central spine of the book, but throughout the text, so people could refer to these images. They say that a picture tells 1,000 words, and it does so in this case. It's part of the journey I took to write this book, Rodney. I mean, I met David Rawdon, and David Rawdon was an incredible man. He bought Mikey's Fontaine in 1968, famous for the Marine Hotel in Hermanus, Lanzarach in Stellenbosch. And a lot of the people that come to my talks, I explain about my relationship with David. And he said to me early on in one of our first meetings, "You write a book about this place, Mikey's Fontaine, and the breakfasts are on me." So that's why I think it took me so long, because the breakfasts are fantastic out there. Now, Dave passed away, unfortunately, in 2010, which was a great sadness to me. And it sort of put the book on hold. But I remember our deal. And that's why I got back on the horse, should I say, and I finished this book. And he's up there smiling, I'm sure, as we're speaking today. But to go back to the images, they actually come from the Logan family archives. And the Logan's grandson, Major John Boost, actually lived at Mikey's Fontaine up to his death in 2004. And I'd heard that he was sitting on an incredible collection of pictures. Now, I'm not the first person to try to write this story of James Logan. Others have tried but have given up. Others have taken artifacts and not returned them. So you can imagine Major Boost. He wasn't very open when I first introduced myself. But I was persistent, and I won his trust, and eventually he gave me access to the collection. Now, I walked into that house at Mikey's Fontaine. It's called Tweedside Lodge. It's James Logan's private dwelling. The first, incidentally, to have its own private electricity supply in South Africa, to have waterborne sewage, which doesn't sound too glamorous, but to be able to flush your toilet in those days was big news. James Logan built Tweedside Lodge, and Major John Boost would live there every kind of one weekend in a month. So I gained access to this building. Oh my goodness, I walked into this room, the famous billiard room, and what I saw just blew me away. On the wall, we had poems from Rudyard Kipling. We had letters from Cecil Rhodes. We had the original silver trophies from the English cricket teams of the 1890s. I realized that I'd struck gold. So I took some images, and that's where the collection comes from. Now, Major Boost, of course, unfortunately passed away shortly after that meeting. And a lot of the artifacts and a lot of the images you see in this book were actually sold off at auction by his daughter. But it was up to me to finish this book, and I did so with the support of his daughter Jenny, who farms at Tweedside, which is just down the road from Mikey's Fontaine. And she was at my launch at Stellenbosch University and here in Cape Town at the book lounge, and was absolutely delighted that these images that they've been sitting on as a family have now seen the light of day.
But just thinking now, Dean, when did the original Logan die? How long ago was that?
Well, James Logan died in 1920. He, at the end of the South African War, the landscape changed, of course. He withdrew from politics in 1908, and then we had the Union of South Africa. Of course, Rhodes was no more. So he knew when to get into things, but he knew when to get out of things. So he lived out his days relatively quietly as a wealthy man at Mikey's Fontaine. But, of course, going back to the archives that I explained, it was a responsibility for me to tell this story. I discovered these incredible images and documents from Rhodes and Lord Roberts and all these wider figures in imperial history and South African history. So that was significant. Now, one of my greatest pleasures in writing this book is what happened last year when the book came out, because for me it was important that these archives be documented and retained and looked after. Remember that I said a lot of it had been sold off at an auction.
Yes, because I wanted to know, Dean, I hope I'm not preempting you, but when the last person died, I'm not sure who's there at the moment, but you can bring us up to date on that. But where are all these artifacts and pictures and cups? Are they safe?
Well, a lot of it, of course, is in the hands of private collectors. They probably don't know what they're sitting on. So if you're out there listening, please, get in touch, because we'd like to document a lot of this. But with the majority of the artifacts that I've mentioned that were in the book, last year at Stellenbosch we had the launch, and I persuaded James Logan's great-granddaughter, Jenny, to attend, and she donated the James Logan archives to Stellenbosch University. So they've been restored and they're able to be accessed by anyone else interested in the story. Going back to Mikey's Fontaine, after Dave's death in 2010, the village went into the ownership of a trust, which is made up of mainly his family. And also the late Liz McGrath arrived on the scene, of course, the great hotelier, the owner of Sellers, Hohenhorst,
right,
etc.
Yes, yes.
And she fell in love with Mikey's Fontaine. I met Liz before she passed away last year. And she's taken the place to the next level. So at the moment, it's in a healthy state. It's being managed by the McGrath Collection. but it's owned in a trust by David Rawdon's family. And of course, I do everything I can to help promote the place and do as much. I haven't got shares in the place. That more the pity, because I think that
emotional shares
is it. But it's part of the deal I had with Dave all those years ago.
Dean, let's have another piece of music. Johnny Clegg here.
Yes, Johnny Clegg, I mean, a South African legend, and his classic tune, Impi, which I think really does stir the emotions in terms of, you know, real African feel. There's a cricket connection here as well, Rodney, and I think it was Lance Klusener who used to walk out to this, you know, the great Zulu cricketer. Really emotive music, and if I'm missing Africa in the cold and grey of England, I often put this tune on.
Impi! Wonansi mpieza Ubani benga chinja mabubesi Impi Wonansi mpieza Ubani benga chinja mabubesi Impi Wonansi mpieza Ubani benga chinja mabubesi
All along the river, James Fitzarmy lay asleep. Come to crush the children of Mageba, come to exact the realm's price for peace. The morning, as they saddled up to ride, their eyes shone with the fire and the steel. The general told them of the task that lay ahead, to bring the people of the sky to heal.
Impi, Bonanza Pieza, Ubani Benga Chinja Mabubesi.
Mud and sweat on polished leather, warm rain seeping to the bone. They rode through the season's wet weather, straining for a glimpse of the foe. Battalion, destined to die, broken by the benders of kings. Vainglorious general, Victorian pride would cost him and 800 men their lives.
Bonanza Pieza, Ubani Benga Chinja Mabubesi.
They came to the side of a mountain. Scouts rode out to spy the land. Even as the realm soldiers lay resting, Mageba's forces were soon at hand.
Johnny Clegg, I think I can say the great Johnny Clegg, that piece called Impi, and imagine listening to that in a cold winter's evening in England, pouring with rain. But that's just what my guest does, Dean Allen, Dr. Dean Allen, who's been my guest on People of Note here on Fine Music Radio this week, talking about his book, which is called Empire, War and Cricket in South Africa. And what a fascinating conversation we've had, Dean, about Mikey's Fontein and these personalities and this extraordinary game of cricket, which is on everybody's lips at the moment. But do you play cricket? I've been meaning to ask you all through the program.
I did at school, and I did the odd social game, but football's been my game, and tennis especially, but I've written about the games of empire, which are rugby and cricket, of course. A lot of my past work has dealt with the first Springbok tours, for example, 1906 and Paul Roos and all those wonderful, wonderful tales. I mean, in 1906, the first ever South African team that left these shores in terms of rugby contained a mixture of Afrikaners and English who had fought against each other in the war. So you can see the comparison here.
Absolutely.
Cricket and rugby, the game of empires, really had some fantastic backstories behind them. I'm not interested in batting averages or bowling performances or who scores the most tries. It's the context in which these games were played at that time.
Which sounds as though that's what this book is all about, the meat of this book. But having said you're not interested in figures and all that, I wonder how you're going to answer this question. As you know, we've just had this test in Cape Town, and the South African team perhaps weren't on top form. Now, with your love of South Africa, who did you support? There you go.
That
you don't have to answer
that. I have been asked that, I think, dozens of times this past week, Rodney, and I think diplomatically, I support both teams. I think from a marketing point of view, I was supporting the team that was behind because I wanted this test match to go on for 5 days so I could talk to as many people about the book as possible. But I'm absolutely delighted after what happened in Durban that South Africa picked themselves up an incredible innings from Hashim Amla and, of course, Bavuma's 100, which I'm a historian. That is history in the making. I mean, the first black African to score a century for South Africa. I mean, that I'll be writing about that in the future.
And presumably you have followed all the controversies. At the beginning we spoke about the Rhodes Must Fall controversy, the issue with colonialism and imperialism, the issue of getting our teams more representative, getting more black people onto the teams. You up on all of that, are
yeah,
you?
Yeah, I mean, of course, as an academic and someone who's a social commentator of South African sport, you have to be aware of things like the quota system, of course. And it is a challenge for South African sport, but it's also something that must be embraced. It's the part of the fabric of this society and its politics, of course. And I don't think many of the English visitors actually appreciate, you know, this dynamic that's in South African sport. It's certainly something that I'm interested in investigating further, and I know, but being here you appreciate it. You appreciate the passion for sports such as cricket and how sports such as cricket, rugby, football bring together the nation. It's so important. It brings together people of different backgrounds. And for me to be able to have contributed for an understanding of how these sports have been formed in the past has been an absolute privilege.
What's your next book? Is there another one in the pipeline?
Well, good question. Yes,
after
yes.
This huge tome.
Yes,
I'd like. What 10 years it took you?
It did. It 10 years of my life. So perhaps a few months off, and but I'm looking at writing. I'm fascinated with the South African War period, and I'm looking at these famous truces that took place during the war. These kind of gentleman exchanges and the significance of sport during that period. So maybe something on sport during the South African War and the wider kind of context of that. So watch this space.
Indeed. Dr. Dean Allen, before we play your last piece of music, thank you very much. The book is called, let's just do some details of the book now, Empire, War and Cricket in South Africa, Logan of Mikey's Fontein. It's published by Penguin and is available, as you say. But give us your website, because I've been to your website and there's a lot of information there about what you do as well.
Yeah, no, thank you, Rodney. No, my website is www.deanallen.co.za. That's Allen with an E-N. And please, if you'd like to visit the website or email me at dean@deanallen.co.za. There's a lot of details of an upcoming book tour that I'll be doing throughout South Africa. I've got a number of talks here in the Cape, but I'm going to places like East London, Johannesburg, Grahamstown, and I'm taking this book on the road, should we say, during March and April. But if your listeners have enjoyed and want to find out more, I'd love to engage in dialogue with that. So please visit my website, and I'm on Facebook and Twitter and all those social media sites. So please do follow me and keep up to date with what I'm up to.
That's Dean Allen, and Allen is spelled A-L-L-E-N. And has the book, just one last quick question, has the book been to Mikey's Fontein?
The book is available at Mikey's Fontein, and it yet sits proudly there in the shop. And they've also shared in the proud news, recent proud news, that it was shortlisted for the non-fiction book of the year, which was a real pride. And the people of Mikey's Fontein are absolutely delighted with it, and I did it. I wrote this book as much for them as I did for myself. So,
Dr. Dina Allen, thank you. And your last piece of music, Just Ginger, Sugar Man.
Well, of course. I mean, we can't play a piece of popular music without mentioning Rodriguez and that incredible story, of course. But I've been clever here because I've combined one of my favourite South African bands, Just Ginger, with one of the most famous South African tracks. So hope you enjoy.
Sugar Man, won't you hurry, 'cause I'm tired of these scenes. For a blue coin, won't you bring back all those colors to my dreams. Silver magic ships you carry, jumpers, coke, sweet Mary.
People of Note is brought to you each week at this time by Peter Turin Productions.